First up this evening, it is telly time. And on tonight's TV reviews, The Girlfriend is a psychological thriller on Prime Video. Robin Wright stars as Laura, a wealthy gallery owner whose idyllic life unravels when her son Daniel introduces her to his girlfriend Cherry. Laura is convinced that Cherry is manipulative and hiding secrets, and it spirals into obsession and confrontation. Also tonight, AKA Charlie Sheen is a Netflix documentary in which the 90s heartthrob candidly recounts his Malibu upbringing, his meteoric rise in Hollywood, and his very public downfall amid addiction and scandal. Now 7 years sober, he reflects on his life, excesses, and ultimate recovery. And finally, Only Murders in the Building is back for season 5. This time, the inquisitive trio of Charles, Oliver, and Mabel are investigating the suspicious death of the Arconia's doorman, Lester. It was ruled an accident, but they don't believe that, and they seek out answers to what really happened, all the while helping a mob wife find her missing husband. And I'm joined now by our reviewers tonight, Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser. It's lovely to have you guys. First tonight, we're going to look at the latest psychological thriller from Prime Video, The Girlfriend. Robin Wright stars as Laura Sanderson, a wealthy art gallery owner whose comfortable life is altered when her son brings home his new girlfriend. Jen, set this one up for us.
Yeah, I have rich people fatigue. Yacht
Don't
fatigue.
We all?
If I see another Italian marble countertop, I'm going to scream. So to say I approached this with trepidation when I fired it up is one thing. So it's based on a 2017 novel by Michelle Francis, and we are ploughing through, I guess, pleasingly familiar territory. You have this simpering mummy's boy, Daniel, played by Laurie Davidson. He's a medical student who actually never seems to do any doctoring in this whole entire series. Anyway, who falls in love with a girl from, quote unquote, the wrong side of the tracks, who's played by Olivia Cook, Cherry. She is wants to kind of fudge her past to be accepted into this fancy family, and she's put under the microscope severely by this formidable matriarch, Laura, played by Robin Wright, whilst the sympathetic dad tries to keep the peace in the middle. So we've kind of seen this trope play out in, I don't know, a million dodgy soap storylines, popcorn films of the 80s and 90s. And it is a thriller in capital letters. And what I mean by that is, from minute one in the opening episode, they've dispensed with any kind of realism in the dialogue, but to the expense of anything regarding characterization. It is literally just get to A to B, to the plot set pieces. Mm-hmm. That's what we're here for. We're here for the explosive scenes. We're not here to actually get down to who these people are. So some of it, at the beginning, I have to say, sounded like, for all the world, the dialogue in a soft porn film. Like when, especially when you're introduced to Cherry, and it's her, Laura's friend Isabella is ripping her to shreds just as she's turning the corner of the house, comparing the name Cherry to something that maybe a lap dancer would have. And then bingo, bango, bongo, here comes Cherry hearing that insult. It just felt like, have we seen this before? Have I been knocked on the head myself?
Okay, well, Chris, there is an interesting device kind of used in The Girlfriend, as each episode is told from either Laura's point of view or from Cherry's point of view, and it's up to the viewer to decide who they believe. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I think it's probably the cleverest trick that this show has, because it turns it into something that you might watch while you're doing something else, to something that all of a sudden you have to pay attention to. Because I just thought, okay, Laura in big red letters, this is her side of the story. Cherry in big red letters, this is hers. But then I noticed the dialogue is changing. Some of the expressions are changing. Some of the actual actions of the supporting characters are changing. So it's adopting this sort of, hey, we have two unreliable narrators sort of angle. So you're going to have to pay attention to this, and you're going to have to pick a side. They're not lying with that tagline, there's two sides to every story. The fact that they tried to do that in every episode, though, that might get a little bit tiring after a while. The one thing that I didn't like at the very beginning, though, was, and this is becoming such a big thing, especially in shows about rich people who have landed themselves in a lot of trouble, there's a violent altercation at the very beginning of the series. And it's just, you know, crash, bang, wallop. We don't actually see someone. We know someone has a knife, and we know someone ends up in the pool. And then all of a sudden, it's 5 minutes later. And that just feels like it's going back to this thing that a filmmaker, Dexter Fletcher, was talking about a while back, where it's almost like the streamers don't trust us.
They don't trust the audience.
They don't trust the audience that if something doesn't happen within the first minute, they might flick off. Because once you know it's 5 months later and we're setting up the characters, it does take a long time. So it just feels from the outset that this show is just out to, you know, there has to be thrills around every corner.
There and sometimes has to be set pieces.
Yeah.
I kept on thinking, this is the Emerald Fennel disease. Yeah. They have really watched Saltburn and have said, how can we emulate this where it's like shock? another shock. We're building up to another shock. So you see something like Cherry violently sabotaging her ex's marriage, the wedding day. I won't go into details, but it's like very stylized, quite gory, but also inexplicable because it happens. She walks away and it looks like a video. It looks like a music video rather than you know, a TV show.
But was the point of that to kind of, you know, tell the listeners there's more to Cherry than what's going on that meets the eye?
But you can do that in a different way, I think. I mean, subtlety is not
It definitely wasn't subtlety.
There's no subtlety at all.
Yeah. So I think that is what you're losing, because you have Claire Underwood here. Let's not forget, this is Robin Wright from House of Cards. Like, she is a great actress and we know she does underlying menacing really well. And I think as it goes on, I think the key to it, the strengths that it does have, is the two female actresses, because Olivia Cooke is great and she goes up against Robin Wright toe to toe, but they're not given the material. And I also thought, why are they wasting their time fighting over this wet blanket? Daniel is a terrible character with no redeeming qualities at all. So you're thinking, should there be this sapphic undertone between the two women, which would have been more interesting? Probably would have tipped into Killing Eve territory, but I would have liked that more than what we got between them, which is just this cat and mouse game that keeps going round and round between them.
And yet I found myself wanting to watch the next episode and wanting to watch the next episode. So there is something to the ingredients of this.
Yeah, maybe it's not entirely awful, because I think it knows what it's actually doing. It knows that it's trashy. It knows that it's soapy. It's overdirected. It's so overdirected. I mean, Robin Wright, you know, is such a talented performer. I'm not quite sure about her directing skills. It's just, it's very heavy handed at the beginning. I think there's some wonderful ideas there, especially this idea, you know, that this working class woman believes that her rich boyfriend's mom is looking down on her, because she is. And then this privileged millionaire is, you know, thinks that, you know, oh, everyone believes that I'm treating my boyfriend's new daughter badly because, you know, she's not good enough for him. But that's what she thinks. And I think those themes and concepts and plot lines, they could be explored with nuance and intelligence and wit. There's none of that really here. It's just, again, let's just thrill the audience. Let's just have something explosive happen in every minute. And then there's no consequences whatsoever.
Mm. I found, Jen, the only realistic character in all of this is Cherry's mother.
Oh, I loved her. Sorry, yeah. Karen Henthorne gives a great performance as Cherry's woebegone mother. But the only thing about it is they keep on just having her say, what have you done now? What's happened now? And you're like, can we give this woman more? Because she's so good. She is the grit and the spice of the show in that way, because she's dealt with Cherry and in all her erratic behaviour. And that's kind of what you want to dig into, what Chris was saying there. I mean, I'm all for a working class woman winning for a change. And I wanted to see what Cherry's motivations were. You get to that towards the end, but it's done in a very sensationalist, explosive manner. I'd rather they dialed it down a bit, stalled the digger in the middle of these six episodes and get to know these characters better than you do, because you also have the loss in Laura's life. She has the loss of a daughter. Yes. It would have been nice to have seen her kind of adopting Cherry as a bit of a daughter figure, which does happen kind of in one episode.
A little bit.
But you want more of that. You want more of these two women exploring each other as people, as characters, and seeing why, you know, Laura feels this way. What happened to her? What happened to Cherry to make her so defensive? And Cherry's mom is such a big part of that. I think to bring her in more would have been something special. And if they had have calmed down the theatrics a bit, it could have been a really good show.
Chris, is it set up for, don't give me any spoilers now, but is it set up for a season two?
Maybe. It goes absolutely bananas towards the end. So maybe this is probably best kept as a self-contained thing. And I will say another thing. Everyone here seems to be enjoying themselves, especially Olivia Cooke and Robin Wright, who do spark off of one another. And I think they do deserve a better show. But I think after 5 or 6 hours, the suspense wears off, the twists kind of start to get a bit stale. It's all a bit too slippery, too soapy. And just that dialogue, just the things that the characters are required to say to each other. Even Cherry's mother walking into a room and reminding Cherry that she's a butcher. Because the audience need to know that she's a butcher. I just wish a lot more thought had gone into this, a lot more substance rather than style, because it is quite stylish.
Why don't we have just a quick listen? Here is Laura, played by Robin Wright. She confronts Cherry, played by Olivia Cooke, in the swimming pool.
This is your ex-boyfriend, isn't it? The man you punched, isn't it? You know, I'm going to have to tell Daniel everything. About all of it. So we're keeping secrets. Is that a threat?
I want you to stay away from my son.
Aww, my two favorite ladies. Did you forget something, Mom? Or did you just miss Cherry?
I cringed so hard at that particular dialogue, so I did. Okay, guys, out of five, how many stars are we giving The Girlfriend?
I mean, I think it's better than The Perfect Couple. It's better than Sirens. It's better than The Better Sisters. So something has to be said for that. So I would give it, I think, a three, because look, the thing about it is it's not about class division, it's not about obsessive love, it's just a big old thrill ride. And if that's what you want for six episodes with two actresses trying to give it their best, I think it deserves a three.
Okay, Chris?
I don't think I can be as generous as that. And if anything, that clip is just reminding me that Laurie Davidson, I wish that Daniel character had been better, or even just acted better, written better. It's 2.5 out of 5, but I would love to see Robin Wright and Olivia Cooke do something better again together.
All right, okay. Now let's move on to AKA Charlie Sheen. It's a 2-part documentary on Netflix about Carlos Erwin Estevez, aka Charlie Sheen, once the highest paid actor in TV, and he filled column inches around the world with stories about his personal life. Chris, tell us about this one.
About Charlie or about the documentary? Charlie Sheen has decided. Charlie Sheen hasn't actually starred in anything since 2017, but is now 8 years sober and has spent the last year or two preparing for this documentary, preparing for the 2025 tell-all year for Charlie Sheen. What I mean by that is he's made a documentary about his career and his past, his personal life, and he's also written a memoir, which is published this week. So they're sort of companion pieces for one another. But it's Charlie Sheen in a diner being shot by documentary maker Andrew Renzi, talking about his life for 3 hours. So it's kind of a 2-part film. And his, you know, once Charlie Sheen is in the room, his voice is always going to be the loudest. But he has a lot of help around him, you know, in different rooms, because for some reason all these people can't be together. John Cryer, one of his co-stars in 2.5 Men, is talking about working with Charlie Sheen. Denise Richards, one of Charlie Sheen's ex-wives, is talking about him. Ramon Estevez, one of his brothers, Martin Sheen and Emilio Estevez, will contribute. And it's just a trip down, you know, Sheen memory lane, you know, back to his childhood. One of the best things about this documentary series is actually the grainy home archive footage of the home videos that Emilio, Charlie, and also their childhood pal Sean Penn, the films that they used to make as kids on a little Super 8 camera. It talks about, you know, how Charlie basically grew up watching his father Martin Sheen play pretend for a living and thought, I want to do that. He saw his brother become a superstar in the 1980s and I thought, I want to be him. And then what happens when he finally got what he wanted, and how, for whatever reason, and this is the big question that everyone asked for 3 hours, when he got everything he wanted. I mean, at one point he was not just, you know, an actor in a Best Picture winner, he was one of the highest paid actors on television. He decided to hit the self-destruct button.
He absolutely did. Jen, it's 3 hours long. I thought Charlie Sheen was very giving in it. He told a lot of stories, especially kind of from his wild years when he was raking in the money and enjoying the excesses that accompanied it. What did you think?
No, I think he told a lot of anecdotes that he's told before, and you can see that there's a polish to them, and it's a very much, I'm a raconteur now and I'm going to tell you about my wild boys days. And that's fun and exciting at the start when you hear those stories about young Nicolas Cage especially.
Absolutely.
And as well about his dad taking out his false teeth before he was going to try and hit him after he tried to escape from rehab. A great story, well told, I have to say. But I think the problem for me lies with Andrew Renzi. Andrew Renzi feels like he is very impressed by Charlie Sheen. He feels like the tone to it is very frat boy. He thinks it's cool. He thinks all the way it's shot, there's a lot of bikini clad girls, even Denise Richards for her time, and she does most of the work here, the emotional labor in the whole film. She is treated in the intro like a disposable Barbie doll. They're all like, oh my God, Denise, she's so beautiful, and all these close-ups of her in different films, and it's very male gaze. And there is this whole idea of machismo, you know. Sean Penn is in love with this idea of the wild boy, the reckless. How can he survive this? Like he's a Dennis Hopper or like he's a Jack Nicholson. And he's not at that level, because at some point they cared about their craft. And you can see with Nicolas Cage, what he has done. Yes, he was crazy. And yes, he's in a million forgettable films. But also there's something within Nicolas Cage that cares about the art form. You do not think that. You do not come away thinking Charlie Sheen does either. And the thing that I found most offensive was, true Andrew Renzi kind of idolizing this man or thinking his life was so out of control and he couldn't do that anymore. The women get lost in this. The women get lost completely. And this man is full of ghosts of women, the darkness of women. You get in the early first episode casually told story about threatening Kelly Preston with a gun and it's glossed over. All you see is Kelly Preston footage from that time denying that it happened, being doorstepped by Access Hollywood. That's it. He doesn't press Charlie Sheen about this. He doesn't press Charlie Sheen about his behaviour towards women at all. So you get Denise Richards telling stories about Charlie Sheen chasing her with a baseball bat. You get his other wife, Brooke Mueller. You hear the 911 call of her saying that he is threatening her with a knife. He has never asked about these things. Never.
And yet the two women, his two ex-wives, both appear in the documentary as well. And for me, it was Denise Richards that stood out because it seems to me that she's still affected by her relationship with Charlie Sheen.
To say, like, she took in the two other children that Sheen had with Brooke Mueller when Brooke Mueller was a drug addict as well. So, you know, Denise Richards took in their children to raise for about a year or so. And like that just shows the mark of the woman. But it also shows how disrespectful Charlie Sheen is.
Yeah. And I think Andrew Renzi, like, you're absolutely right. Like, he does let Charlie off so lightly, especially around conversations of his alleged violent altercations with his ex-wives. Whereas when he's talking to Denise Richards, Denise Richards is honest and emotional and actually says something quite profound that, you know, despite all of the trouble and the heartache and the supposed violence that she endured, that she still loves him. And that's a really honest moment in the documentary that is not quite honest with its actual subject. And again, it's just one wild anecdote after another. It's like, oh, this one time we were so high, I pretended to be a pilot on a plane and told everyone that the plane was going down. And then we just move on. And it's 100 stories like that. And you're thinking, the only thing more boring than actually doing something like that is listening to someone like Charlie Sheen talk about doing that. And I just wanted to know, I think also it's very inward looking. I wanted to know more about the culture around Charlie Sheen and his family. Why Charlie Sheen, who, let's face it, has never been all that great of a performer, how he was allowed to ascend and then inevitably, you know, fall down basically.
Okay, what I found interesting was a story about Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Jennifer Grey getting him that iconic, you can call it an iconic, you know, short piece in that movie as well. Also, I'd forgotten about Spin City. And then also, I'd kind of forgotten about Two and a Half Men as well. So, and Hot Shots. Hot Shots, I just loved that movie. So for me, the nostalgia of that was kind of interesting to look at the little bit of a TV and movie career.
I think the thing about it is, for me, it's really about how men are, society cannot wait to redeem men, no matter what they do. Because even he says it himself. He was like, how were they letting me do, like, Hot Shots landed in my lap after I was absolutely, you know, chased out of Hollywood for being an addict. And if you look at the trajectory of someone like Drew Barrymore's career, she did not have that same soft landing. She was around cleaning Burger Kings out of rehab because nobody wanted to touch her. She was, quote unquote, a hot mess. And he was like, the same with Two and a Half Men. He was like, I don't know how this happened, but sure, am I lucky? And it feels like there's this sheen of Nepo Baby or this sheen of, that sheen being the operative word, that he just won't admit to or won't call, they won't actually confront him about it, that makes this a real missed opportunity to dig into where is he at and what does he think about those things. All he keeps on saying is, you know, that I'm lucky to be here or I have to be here for a reason to have survived all this, but I don't think we know why this has happened or, you know, we never get to him accounting. There's no accountability.
Oh, yeah, it's basically just a documentary about all of this mad stuff that happened without ever asking why did it happen? How did it happen? And where is he now? I mean, like, what is he actually going to do? It's going back to that thing of, do you actually love acting? Do you enjoy telling stories? I don't ever get that from him at all.
The feeling that I get that there's a big, massive shadow of Martin Sheen kind of standing over him. And I found that the emotional parts of the documentary, they did mention his father and it was like a son just looking for absolute validation from his dad the whole way throughout the documentary.
It felt a little bit forced at times though. So, you know, kind of blending the footage from Apocalypse Now where Martin Sheen's character is clearly going through a rough time and he really actually did go through a rough time there. And Charlie Sheen sort of credits himself as a child helping his father back from the brink when his father was drinking heavily on the set, actually suffered a minor heart attack while he was filming. But I just feel Martin Sheen declining to be involved kind of speaks volumes because he doesn't want to revisit the worst parts of his life. Why would he?
Let's have a listen to the doc. Charlie talks about seeing his father in the Philippines when he was recovering from substance abuse.
When we came back to the Philippines and saw him for the first time, he was taking baby steps on a cane and he was crying and he was devoid of that dad light. It was gone, you know? I had brought a couple of baseball gloves. I was playing baseball at the time. And so we'd go out somewhere on the grounds and we'd start throwing the ball. And the first day it might have been at 5 feet for 10 throws. And the next day it might have been at 10 feet for 15 throws. And this went on and on and on until we were at a decent distance and, you know, just playing catch. He credits me with having a major hand in helping him during his rehab to get his strength back, get his focus back, get his life back. Yeah, this fucking mattered. Yeah, it redefined that age-old moment of a father-son playing catch. But it's hard not to visit that and not get a little choked up because I know what it meant to him, what it still means to him, you know?
I was watching it and there's a real, am I right in saying this, like a naivety about Charlie Sheen or this air of somebody who didn't grow up past 20 years of age.
Mm. And maybe I think sometimes it's like he's trying to justify that golden existence that he did have by saying, you know, but I was living on the precipice of losing it all. So that's the only thing you can do when you have everything. I think that's his mentality, which is, but I suppose after years of therapy, in and out of therapy, I feel like he hasn't learned that much, really. And I just found it, I don't know, I just think those, that in what we're living in now, the like post-Me Too world, I found the tone of this to be extremely strange, that there was no really interrogation of his behaviour or how he feels psychologically or who he is as a person. It's just nice tales and tales that are extreme and extreme behaviour. And it does kind of look at, when we get into the Tiger Blood situation, that issue of the relationship the media has and the relationship with the, you know, fans have with these.
I remember
kind of
it at the time, it was everyone was walking around saying winning.
Yeah, yeah,
I remember that was
so
kind
strange.
Of, you know, it was really, it's really strange to look back at that now, having lived through it. You know?
Yeah, and it's so weird that this is barely 15 years ago that Charlie Sheen, a man who was just horrible to the people that he worked for, Chuck Lorre on Two and a Half Men, and worked with John Cryer, and yes, yeah, and he was dismissed, and yet America took his side, and we heard the recordings of the names that he called his co-stars and his employers, and still America was like, okay, we'll buy tickets to see this man. This man, Charlie Sheen, went on tour without a show. He just sat on stage just talking about winning and Tiger Blood and how the Tiger Blood thing
and
never
people
made.
People turned up in their droves.
Yeah, and then came out of the theatres afterwards. Actually, that's good footage of the people coming out of the theatre afterwards and saying, what was that? I want my money back. Don't go see this guy. Yeah. Of course he wasn't going to put on a show. He was just, he was doing nothing.
Yeah. Okay, guys, how many stars out of five?
I'm going to give this, look, I mean, I think if you want just to go back in time and have a good few Hollywood anecdotes, just you can watch the first one and get out pretty clean. So with that, I will say it's two for, I was going to say two and a half for Two and a Half Men, but no, just the straight down two, because I don't think I want to hear Sean Penn talk ever again. And
no.
I don't think I want to hear Charlie Sheen rhapsodize about his life ever again either.
Okay, fair enough. Chris?
I think there's a fascinating film to be made about Charlie Sheen because he's a fascinating person, but this isn't it. I think it's going to take someone away from the Sheen camp basically to make that film. So two stars.
Okay, I also think the fact that he's even alive is kind of incredible.
Incredible.
So
yeah.
Does he, and that's the thing, he's so impressed with that. That's what this film is about.
All right.
I live.
Okay. Now finally this evening, the Disney roller coaster Only Murders in the Building is back with our amateur sleuths Charles, Oliver and Mabel, played by Steve Martin, Martin Short and Selena Gomez, and this is their fifth murder mystery. Chen, bring us up to speed with this season.
Yeah, I mean, look, I just think we're now at season five and we know that we're in safe hands, so you know what to expect. And if you're expecting something more dynamic from this time around, you're not going to get it. I really feel that it's kind of closed in itself a bit this time around, so it's fans only, which can go both ways. And so when we left season four, I actually think you could have wrapped things up last season, because you had Oliver, Martin Short's character, and Loretta, Meryl Streep's character, Marion. There's this air of finality to it that it would have been a sweet way to end things for the gang. And they were thinking about their movie adaptation and thinking about the next move for the podcast. But the finale, when it happened, spoiler alert if you haven't seen this yet, there was a case, there's another murder that has happened. So it's the affable, unassuming doorman Lester He was found dead in the fountain. And then this mob wife, played by Taya Leone, shows up offering them a new case to find her missing husband, Nicky, played by Bobby Cannavale. And it was clear that this season is going to have this mob flavour to it. And after last time around with Paul Rudd's Irish turn, I was very, very worried about what would happen this season. And there is a lot of Brando impressions. There is a lot of, you know, talking about the mafia in that way. But like, the good thing about it is, for me, you get Oliver talking about his ill-fated musical Newark, Newark, which was worth all the red sauce ridiculousness, especially when you meet the sons of the mob boss. And but actually, it turns out the mob connection is a bit of a red herring, because what it is, it's taking us back to Leicester, it's taking us back to Darconia, and that's where the main drive of the mystery is actually happening.
Okay, let's have a listen. This is Charles, Oliver and Mabel. They found another mystery to solve, as I said, played by Steve Martin, Martin Short and Selena Gomez.
It is a finger, right?
I don't think it's a toe.
Is it a male finger? Female? I can't even tell what race it is.
I think its main attribute is dead. Looks like there's some sort of green fungus on the nail.
Don't pick it up!
She picked it up.
I knew she would.
Okay, Oliver, did anyone at your wedding mention an accident in the kitchen?
Yes, Mabel, but I kept it to myself. Do better! Please, nobody accidentally slices off their finger and then accidentally puts it into a vintage shrimp goblet.
He's right. We gotta quit saying accident. This is a message.
So creepy. It's like the horse head in The Godfather. Very mobby.
Hey.
Sophia Catchemilio.
Who is that? What's that?
On your wedding night, the night Lester died, this mysterious woman,
Rilla, femme fatale,
asked us to help her find her missing mobster husband, Nicky.
A mob wife? And what did you say?
That we weren't a detective agency.
You turned down a mob wife? Oh, my God. Show me a photo of Sophia Catchemilio. Oh, look at them. A classic mob couple. No honest man wears a flower that big.
Yeah, okay, right. Chris. In series 3 and 4 of Only Murders, the trio left the building and many kind of felt that the series suffered because of that. But now the producers have returned to form, and more importantly, it returned to their Arconia this time.
Yes, it's called Only Murders in the Building for a reason. I think season 3 went to Broadway, and then season 4 took us to Hollywood for the Only Murders in the Building film. Mm. We're back in the Arconia, and this is all about the Arconia. So that was one of the things that worked for me. There's a, I don't think Jen liked this, but the second episode is this, I quite liked it. It's a lovely history of Lester the doorman, and we go back to when he's portrayed by Emery Cohn in his younger years, and how it was an accidental career for him. He wanted to be an actor, but all of a sudden, you know, 35 years later, he was, you know, one of the longest running doormen in New York, and all of the things that he saw, the lives that he touched. You know, we see Charles Haden Savage, Steve Martin's character, in his glory days. We see Oliver Putnam, you know, just as his theatre career is about to go south, and we see Mabel as a little girl. So all of that stuff worked really well. It's kind of reminiscent of the kind of things that they used to do in the second season. But I will say, once we get into the mystery of things, and you know, Nicky's disappearance, some eccentric New York billionaires come in, played by some very famous faces. Christoph Waltz is in there, Renee Zellweger. It gets very convoluted, a little bit confusing, so outlandish. There's a scene where the characters are actually performing an autopsy at one stage, and I'm thinking to myself, even for this show, that is too much. So the joke is a little staler, it's a little bit rusty, but I should say, I am incapable of giving this thing a bad review, because I really think after four years, I think Short, Martin and Gomez, a partnership that I don't think anybody thought was going to work, it's one of the loveliest friendships in television. And every time I see them, it's like old friends. And the conversation might not flow as, you know, as easily as it did, you know, but you know that there's a belly laugh around every corner. You know that you're going to come away from it feeling a little bit better. So I think So-So Only Murders is better than No Only Murders.
Okay, because I parked it after the first series.
No, go back.
You're
allowed
to go back.
The TV you're making me go, to go back. Maybe I should. And just, I want to talk to you about the big names. Does Only Murders in the Building, we've had Paul Rudd, Meryl Streep, does the series need the big names?
No.
I don't think
no.
so.
No, I don't. But I get why they're there. And like with Meryl Streep, especially because of this weird, we don't know what's happening with her and Martin Short. I like that she's added into the gang. Hmm. And I think she's absolutely fantastic, obviously. And the thing, she's not in the first three episodes. She's in New Zealand. Obviously, Meryl's off filming. But you know when Only Murders gets it right, it sings. And I know when she comes back into it, which will be soon, there will be that chemistry between her and Short that is undeniable. And but also you have this gorgeous strain of melancholy that Steve Martin does so well, because it's about the passing of time. And it is about the fact that they're only getting older, him and Martin Short, and the characters within this are only getting older. There's only so long they can go on for. And Steve Martin's character, when he sees Oliver in this nuptial bliss, he's thinking again about what happens to him. I'm lonely too, and what happens to me being alone, bouncing around the Arconia. And it is about mortality, and I think that's the beating heart in it, because we have such affection for these actors and we have such affection for these characters that it is tinged with this finality to it. So anytime a new season comes along, you're like, we're getting another one, it's okay. Because I think it does something to us with regards to nostalgia. We have nostalgia for Martin Short and Steve Martin growing up with them. We also have a nostalgia for this fantasy of New York. This is a New York that only exists on illustrations in the New Yorker magazine. It only exists in the snow globe of New York City that you might buy in a, you know, tourist shop. And it's very warm. It's also, which we don't like to admit, it is the New York of Woody Allen, early Woody Allen films. And because we can't watch Woody Allen films anymore without feeling residual guilt, I think that Hoffman, you know, John Hoffman, the showrunner, is giving us that without the guilt. Because you know that we even have someone like Diane Wiest is in it this time around. She's playing, you know, Lester's wife, and she was obviously a big player in Woody Allen films. So there's this kind of comforting way to it, that you feel like you're entering into that world again. And that's gorgeous, and that's bliss. And it's also the way that it's made, it's beautifully put together. And you never have that worry or feeling that you do when you're watching a lot of slop that we get treated to. There's a lot of care done within these shows. Every episode feels like a gorgeous chocolate box, even though, like episode two this time, I did not like the de-aging. I mean, Martin Short looked like he was in his wig from Clifford. Like, how bad. Also, how did Lester, he's supposed to be this doorman for, what, 35 years or something. He, at one point, Howard looked like older than him. And you're like, where's this age?
Okay. Yeah, it didn't make sense.
The aging did not make sense.
It didn't make sense. No, very quickly, stars.
I'm going to go with three.
Jen. I'm going to go with four. I love it. Four for Martin Short all day long.
I think you might have convinced me to revisit it. Anyway, a massive thank you to Jen and Chris. The Girlfriend is streaming on Prime Video, aka Charlie Sheen, is available on Netflix. And Only Murders in the Building Season 5 is on Disney Plus. We've got three new albums arriving this week from artists at very different stages of their careers. Ed Sheeran adds to one of the most successful catalogues in contemporary pop with the release of Play. Following a decade of chart-topping singles and global tours, the new record extends his full run of releases that have made him one of the world's best-selling artists. British pop artist Sophie Ellis-Bextor returns with her eighth studio album, Perimenopop. She has sustained a career spanning more than two decades, and her latest work arrives as a murder on the dance floor finds a new audience through its use in the film Saltburn. And finally, Brooklyn-born singer-songwriter King Princess, real name Michaela Strauss, returns with her third album. Since her 2019 debut, Cheap Queen, she has built a reputation for mixing confessional lyricism with sharp-edged pop, and Girl Violence continues that idea. And I'm delighted to be joined by Louise Bruton and John Marr. Let's start with Ed Sheeran and the track Opening.
It's a long way up from rock bottom. There's been times I felt I could fall further. I have loved and lost and feared and prayed. But now the day bursts wide. I wonder if he's
proud. Okay, so that is a little bit of Ed Sheeran's Opening. Never been cool, but never been a has-been. It has been 20 years, which actually I'm really surprised by, since Ed Sheeran's first self-released album. And he's still one of the most recognisable names in pop. Do you feel like Play shows him evolving with the times, Louise?
No, that is. This is a man who is stuck in former glories. Glories that have probably came at a point in cultural history where we needed some soothing. But right now, this kind of soothing balm just seems very I don't know, there's an inauthentic quality to it. It's saccharine in parts. The rap, it's not the only rap on the album. I feel that there is something kind of culturally off as well with this Halifax-born, Suffolk-raised, culturally Irish white man rapping in a way that isn't actually rap. He's just throwing a lot of words out there at once, which I'm aware I'm doing right now as well. But that's that's out of fury. But I'm not going to be putting this on MP3 and calling it a rap.
John, like, he's often praised for accessibility, but he's criticised for being formulaic. Where do you think this album lands in terms of that whole world?
Oh, both. It's an unbelievably accessible album. This will be enormously popular on streaming platforms in virtually every country in the world. In fact, talk about appropriation. There's a bit of Indian kind of influence going on here. It's very, very mild Indian influence, I must say, but it is there. And it's incredibly accessible. I felt on the first time I'm listening to this album that I've heard all of these songs before. And that's exactly because he is among the most formulaic musicians at work today. It is a challenge to make music that has enormous global appeal. But one way to do it is to kind of repeat yourself over and over again. The last album he made was called Autumn Variations. And I thought it was okay because he was trying a little bit of risk taking. It was a sense of somebody who was aware of his enormity, but was going, let me do my thing for a little bit. Whereas now, at every turn on this album, it feels like the work of a huge committee going, how do we make songs that will appeal to the maximum number of people, offend nobody, get on radio, immediately work on Spotify, and let's do that. And that's exactly what they've done.
Okay. I found that I was listening to the likes of Old Phone, for example. He does have an ability to write a song which we're all thinking, but we can't put into words ourselves. There is a nostalgia that he has around particular tracks. Louise?
There is. There's one thing that he does very well, and that is he's very good at writing love songs. He's a man who feels love, and he's able to capture that moment of, I don't know, believing that there is a forever. And I'll leave that as a dot, 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 and where my cynicism lies on that as well. He is competing with a lot of other musicians at the moment who have begun their careers with him as their inspiration. One of them is Lewis Capaldi. And the song Camera really feels like a song that Lewis Capaldi could be releasing lately. But it just feels that maybe there isn't enough, there is too many of these men with this pained vocal outpouring of love hogging up the charts, and I just feel like it's not delivering enough. There's not a lot of depth in it, and in certain songs there's a little more, and also the opening track there are certain kind of strains of darkness going on in the lyrics, but they don't really push over to his vocal delivery. And I think it would be really interesting if Ed Sheeran went to a darker, angrier place, because he actually has got lots to be angry over. The first track opening is about makes reference to the death of one of his best friends and when his wife was undergoing cancer treatment, and how the pressure of fame means that he can't even go to the playground with his kids. And, you know, just there's the excesses of fame that go with that as well. He's got lots to say, but he's not really saying it in a very eloquent way. But I feel that if he let his anger actually bubble over, I think he could get something far more interesting rather than a little more, which is a shiny, brassy pop song that takes little pops at people but never goes the full way.
Yeah, it's funny because I was listening to Heaven as well, and that reminded me of a song that Justin Bieber could have out right now as well. So, you know, you're right in terms of that. John, do you think at this stage in his career, do you think that Ed Sheeran has the ability or even the appetite at this stage to reinvent himself?
I don't think he has the appetite.
Do you reckon?
I really don't, because in a way, why would he when he is among the most streamed artists of all time? Like, he's in the top five, I think, in terms of all-time top streamers. And he is making enormous amounts of money from his music. And there is something obviously appealing about selling out Croke Park. Now, he's coming to the Three Arena before the end of the year because he's taken this album on a kind of an arena tour. It is also the first of a planned five series. Just as the kind of mathematical...
Well, then he's going to have to reinvent himself.
But that previous series tended to be kind of variations on the same theme to a degree. And I realise there are a lot of people that will probably be listening to this now who adore this guy, and the music speaks to them in a way that I suppose a cynic like me might scoff at. And they find something quite authentic to him. I think there is sincerity, but it's contrived. And for me, I think of kind of Hallmark Holidays and greeting cards, that kind of lyrical sentiment. It's just a bit banal. It's a bit pedestrian.
Mm-hmm. Because in fairness, I've been playing Ed Sheeran tracks on the radio for 16 years and he knows how to write a radio hit when he does. You know, I just couldn't find the radio hit in this album.
Yeah, that is a big thing. And it's something that he is very used to. But like we said, it's been 20 years and there is this kind of huge expectation on the modern era of pop stars to maintain the success over this period of time. And it would have been like thinking that the Rolling Stones could have a number one hit in 1999. There is this phasing out period where they can't be as relevant as they were every single decade of their career.
All right. OK, guys, stars for Ed Sheeran's play. John?
It's two from me, and I'm being a little generous there. The production is sublime and some of the arrangements are beautiful, but it's generally a very weak album and I won't be returning to it.
Okay, Louise?
I'll echo his two. I come out learning very little new about him or his personal taste.
All right, okay, now let's move on to Sophie Ellis-Bextor and her new album, Perimenopop. Louise, great title.
That is probably the best album title of the year. We don't even need to hear the rest of the albums. And where that title came back from was that Sophie Ellis-Bextor turned 46 last month, and she has often been told that pop is a young person's game, but she loves music. She loves making music. She loves performing. She loves pop music. So this is her celebration of her career and all of the women who've gone before her and the women who can go on making pop music beyond being 18 years old. So it's a celebratory stance. And there's something quite exciting about this album where I think this is her Jessie Ware moment of where she finds her voice in pop music, which means that she doesn't get stuck in the ballad phase that sometimes can happen. And it's very fun. It's very optimistic.
Let's have a listen. Here is Sophie Ellis-Bextor at Freedom of the Night. I can imagine people on the dance floors listening to this particular Sophie Ellis-Bextor track. Now, John, she had an unexpected resurgence in recent years, from kitchen discos to Saltburn reviving Murder on the Dance Floor. How do you think that momentum has shaped this new album for her?
Well, it's absolutely brought her back into public consciousness and probably brought her into the minds of a completely new generation. People who weren't born when her first major hit, Groove Jet, came out all those years ago. I enjoy this album so much. It's such a delightful kind of contrast to Ed Sheeran. Partly because I love electropop, and I think if anybody really loves electropop, they will get so much enjoyment from this. I mean, it opens with a song called Relentless Love, and I've written here it's a veritable floor filler. I mean, you put that on anywhere globally and you've got people out. And if that's played in Dublin tonight, the dance floors will heave. And I love the fact that she is just saying, you know, I'm in my mid-40s, I don't care. Why should that matter if the music is good? And if the inspiration is there, which it is, it's another beautifully produced album, but it just works. And there's very few that you'll want to skip through here.
Okay, let's have a listen to Relentless Love. I feel this album is just relentless fun. I think three of us are on the same page with it. What stars are we given, John?
A very solid four for
You're
me.
You're going to be bopping away in your kitchen tonight.
Absolutely.
To this album.
I mean, I'll be playing this in the car on the way home.
Louise?
3.5 for me. I love it, but I just wish there was an extra bit of pow-pow to it bring it to
Gotcha. Dreams. Okay, that's fair enough. Now, stay with me because we're going to be talking about King Princess in just a moment. Now, I'm joined in studio by Louise and John. We're talking albums. This is King Princess and her latest album. Let's have a listen to Girls.
asleep alone again. You keep trying to enter my head, and I'm dying to let you back in, but that would be violence, that would be chaos, and that would be fighting. Girls, bring me to my knees. Girls, bring me to my knees.
That was King Princess with Girls. Now, the album title is provocative, Louise, Girl Violence. How does that phrase make you think about the what does it make you think about in the context of the music that you're listening to?
Okay, so a good way to proceed the any chat about this album is that King Princess is a queer woman, and this comes off the foot of her experiencing a breakup that is changing her perspectives, and felt her world was left shattered and allowed her to find the agency and creative spirit to create the record she has always wanted to. So, you know, you can always hear something like that and be like, oh, this could be a mixed bag of what we get. The album starts a little bit slow, and it opens up with the title track, Girl Violence, which is this confessional outpouring that cites that, yes, girls are as bad as the boys, which is, you know, we don't really need to be told that in this day and age. And there has been sort of chat that this is her big pop album, which is a big statement to make when there's so many of the pop girlies really popping hard this year. And it's maybe the fifth track that you kind of get this, what she intended to make. It's Cry, Cry, Cry. And it's this sort of a pop punk revenge track that says all of the harsher things that Sabrina Carpenter couldn't say in her music. And Sabrina says these things, but King Princess goes harder. And I feel like that's the sound that she was going for, instead of these dreamy 1950s songs that she has been making for most of her career, and as we just heard there in Girls. So it takes a while for her to find her pace, but when she does, I think it's great. And the last few tracks of the album, instead of being more pop orientated, I think she borrows a bit from the indie sleaze. Time, I hear a lot of Weezer, I hear a lot of the Strokes, and I think that that's probably a more interesting sound for her to follow through on with.
Okay, John, King Princess, she first broke through some big industry, she had some big industry backing and co-signs. Do you think, and just on the back of what Louise said there, that she's still chasing mainstream pop success, or has she carved out a different identity at this point with this album?
I think she's leaving the mainstream behind to a degree. I mean, Mark Ronson was who put her into the spotlight. She was on his label initially, and she appears on his fantastic Late Night Feelings album. But there's a Phoebe Bridgers vibe to a lot of this kind of scuzzy, lo-fi indie. The songs that Louise mentions, Cry, Cry, Cry and Girls, are really good here, I think. But it's a bit uneven as an album.
All right. Okay, very quickly, guys. Stars, John?
3 from me.
All right, Louise?
4 from me.
4 from you. Okay, thank you so much for chatting to me on Arena this evening.